dedicated to each and every one of you who appreciate a great glass of wine. You know what I mean?
It's time to unscrew, uncork, or savor a bottle, and let's start exploring the wine glass. In today's episode, I sit down with Jim Schlechter, author of Professional Drinking. When you read a bio that includes soccer player, climbed Kilimanjaro, and enjoys wine, you know it's going to be an interesting interview. Jim went from writing books about being a productive CEO to obtaining his sommelier certification. So it's only logical for him to combine the two. Listen in as Jim provides his tips on how to become a professional drinker. Music by Kevins, publisher KTF Publishing, distributor AWAL label KTF Music. Welcome back to Exploring the Wine Glass podcast, the podcast for people who love wine and want to explore it more. I'm Lori Budd, a UC Davis winemaking program, Sommelier Service, and WSET Level 2 graduate. You can find Exploring the Wine Glass on all of the socials as well as your favorite podcast catchers. Thank you to everyone who has given us a review. Leaving a review on iTunes or the purple icon or whatever the heck it's called will drive us up the charts and allow more wine lovers to find us. If you haven't subscribed yet, now is the perfect time. I promise, I'll never tell you what to drink, but I'll always share what's in my glass. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Allure of the Poor, sponsored by Dracena Wines. I am your host, Lori, and today I have a special guest with you. He is an author of some amazing books. He started off, I believe, writing about CEO management books, but you know what? He got that wine bug, and that bug just doesn't go away. It just kind of grows and grows and grows. And now his latest book he has authored is Professional Drinking, and that is a very exciting topic to be discussing on Exploring the Wine Glass. So please welcome Jim Schlechter.
Hey, Lori, how are you? Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. So first of all, I am so happy to have you on here. You had sent me an electronic copy of your book, and I did read through it, and it's got some pretty cool tips in there, and a lot of me doing a head nodding, going, yep, 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 and very cool stuff. So before we get into the whole heart of the matter of professional drinking and how somebody can go about learning more about drinking, let's get into your origin story. So in your book, your dedication of the book is to your father, Henry, and in it, it states, who started me on my wine journey and taught me to value the great company and conversation. So please share that wine journey with us.
Yeah. So my father, who's unfortunately passed away, He started me when I was young, and, you know, after dinner we'd get a little bit of cordials, you know, Frangelico and sticky sweet, like, I can't even believe I drank this stuff, but as a kid it was kind of cool. And, but really there was one case of wine he got, and it was, while I was in college, and it was a 1982 Hope Lyon, so it's a Bordeaux first growth. 82 was a fabulous, fabulous year for those that remember. And when I would come home from college, you know, on Thanksgiving and hot weekends every so often, he would pull out a bottle of wine and cook steaks. And that wine was just magical. You know, just it was complex and interesting. And it just had everything I thought a wine should be. And as I went through my, you know, business career, I tried different wines. I tried to learn more. But honest to gosh, nothing tasted like that special wine. And really, as I reflect on it, it was the wine and the conversation and the event all coming together to make it really special for me, and has a place in my heart. But that was really where you had to pick a seed for the journey or seed for the tree. That's where it sits.
Well, that's a heck of a seed. I would love to have that seed. Holy.
Yeah, we started here.
And that's kind of a problem, because when you start way up here, you know, it's a little tough to maintain that. I mean,
it was. Yeah. Well, I have to say, his journey started from more humble beginnings. We grew up in Northern California.
Okay.
In Saratoga. and the Paul Masson Winery was just right around the corner from us. So if you remember the carafe wine, you know, with the little aluminum cap, that's what they drank growing up. So we started a little below that particular case of wine. Yeah.
Well, you can't always have, you know, the Moutons of the world or the Lafitte's and all of that. So I see you are sipping. It's a little early here. I am on the West Coast. So why don't you know, I cannot see a glass of wine and not ask what's in your glass. So tell me what you got there.
Well, funny enough, you got me on my birthday.
Well, so, happy birthday.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. It's a 2007 Behringer Private Reserve.
Oh, okay.
So a Bordeaux blend, Napa grown, Howell Mountain is where some of the grapes are grown, and just, you know, 13 years old. It's just perfect, just delicious. So I figured it was sort of an open that bottle night, right? So
there
I was going to talk to you about wine. I said, I got to have a glass of wine.
Absolutely. And I normally do, but if I start at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I don't get too far into the evening.
Absolutely. Well, it's six here, so it's definitely cocktail hour.
Yes, definitely. So I read in your bio that you're a soccer player. You climb Kilimanjaro and you enjoy wine. So, all right, two out of the three, okay. All right, you know, all right, that's loads of people in this world, you know. But climbing Kilimanjaro, like how? What, how did this even come about?
You know, it was on the bucket list. It was just one of those things that I really wanted to do. And it was a few years back at this point, but I said, you know, I'm going to go climb Kilimanjaro, and it's all guided. You have porters and people with you. You don't do it by yourself. So I asked a bunch of friends, and they said, Kilimanjaro? Sure, which maybe shows you what kind of friends I have. And so we went. Now, I have to say, this was not exactly roughing it. We showed up at base camp, you know, getting ready to hike, and we met our team. There were five of us in the group. There were 38 porters bringing our stuff up the mountain. Yeah, 38.
Oh, my gosh.
So it was kind of luxurious. Like, I didn't set up a tent. I didn't roll out my sleeping bag. I mean, I can do that, not at Kilimanjaro. So really, your job was to get your body up the mountain, funny enough. And that was it, actually. That was all we had to do.
But that is still, in its own right, a lot. I mean,
It's very high, yes.
How long did it take you to do that?
There are shorter routes and longer routes. We took a longer route because we wanted to have kind of fun. And it turns out that you acclimatize at a certain rate. And if you go slower, your probability of making it to the top is higher. If you go fast, there's a chance you get altitude sickness and you can't make it to the top. So we didn't want that to happen. So we took 7 days, seven up, two down, which is pretty luxurious compared to, like, there's some three up one day. But I can't imagine who does that. That's kind of crazy in my book. So, yeah, we took our time. But it was a great trip. I loved it. It was great.
How difficult was it to breathe up on top? I mean, even though you acclimated, how difficult is it?
You know, at the beginning, you're going very slowly. They have a Swahili word, pole pole, slowly, slowly.
Okay.
In the beginning, you're like, come on, man, let's go. Like, we can really move. The last day when you're on the top, they're going pole pole, you're like, this is good. This is just about right. So you go the same pace the whole time, and in the beginning it feels terribly slow. And by the time you hit the top, you're like, I'm glad we're going this slow. So a couple of steps, take a few breaths, It was it was a bit of work to get to the top, yeah.
Who was the weak link?
Sickness, and everybody made it, so it was happy.
I was going to say, was there a weak link with somebody that, like, why did
we
I do this?
We had blue lips at the top, but
they
got up and they got down. Yeah, they got down. It was all good.
Wow, that's amazing. That is so cool. Like, really, okay. I mean.
So I gotta finish the story though. So the next morning we're at high base camp. And I met this guy, older guy, John, and I got talking to him, and I said, John, you know, what did you do? He said, well, I climbed the mountain yesterday. I'm like, awesome. He's clearly older, right? told me this whole story about how he climbed Whitney, so he's Southern Californian, and he was joking. His friend said, "What are you going to do next?" He said, "Well, I'm going to climb Kilimanjaro." And he goes, "So here I am with his daughter, who's older as well." I go, "Man, John, that's just amazing." And I got to ask, like, how old are you? He said, "Well, I'm going to have a birthday next week." All right, how old are you going to be at your birthday? 80 years old.
Kudos
so
to
what
him.
You're all impressed with yourself about, you know, I get it. You're like, this 80-year-old guy is cruising by you. That's great. So it was awesome. Good for him.
That is fantastic. I mean, it all just shows it's not the number that matters, right? It's your, it's how you live your life. And yes, exactly. You're what you mentally strength, what mental strength you have, you know? I think about it. I had hip surgery in February, so I'm gradually getting myself back to running and doing things like that. So I'm on my treadmill because the smoke out here is too bad to really be outside. I made a whole half hour run, without stopping, right? But I couldn't do. Nice. I needed to have it's one of those iFit things, so I have the trainer and all that. I'm like, I put the trainer down and put on like some comedy video show because I knew my mental strength was like, oh my God, it's my first half hour running. I'm gonna die. So I put on comedy, so I could entertain myself. Yeah. And then before I knew it was a half an hour. So it's all mind what you can do.
Well done. Now you need to go for 45 minutes,
yeah,
and an hour.
So I am very curious how you go from writing books about how to be an effective CEO to then becoming a certified sommelier.
Yeah, there are a lot of people that have asked me that question. You know, like probably all my hobbies, why do it a little bit when you can climb Kilimanjaro, right? You
know? I love the attitude.
I've always loved wine, back to that original case, and I've been casual, and I fell in with a group of friends who were wine aficionados locally, and I was just always amazed at their knowledge. I mean, just profound. And I read books and stuff, but it just never stuck. And so, you know, I'm going to try to become certified in something that'll force me to learn. I need like a structure, you know? And so I went and took the introductory sommelier class cold, and I passed it probably by the hair on my chinny chin chin. I mean, I studied up, but I really probably shouldn't have passed. And then for the next literally 2 years, I was tasting every week. I was studying. I worked up a program called WSET, Wine and Spirits Education Trust, to an advanced level there to become more theoretically knowledgeable. And the test is three parts, service, theory, and tasting. So the theory was the WSET. The tasting, I fell in with a woman who was a advanced sommelier, Ellie Bechamel, and she was fabulous in teaching me how to taste as well as others. And then service, I had done waited tables in college, and so I was pretty good around a table and how to handle people and so forth. And but the origin of that was, you know, I'd go out to dinner with my clients, CEOs, and these decisive, intelligent, powerful people, you know, in their day jobs, like masters of the universe. You hand them a wine list and they're like, they don't know what to do. They get nervous, the flop sweat starts, and like, man, that's weird that like these crazy accomplished people can't feel comfortable around wine and spirits. And so there's a need there. So that's why I combined the sommelier with the business thing. So, and that was the book.
There you go. So you find a niche and you go to it. But I do find it very interesting. I get that, like, some people, we go out to dinner, and everybody, you know, the wine list comes and everybody's like, "She'll take it," you know?
Yeah.
And I'm like, you guys can do that. Like, I don't know what is so scary about a wine list, but it does. It brings very prominent people to their knees, shaking like an infant, you know, of worried about it. And I guess I just have the attitude of, even before I did all of my education and all of that, So what's the worst case scenario? You pick a wine that, you know, and you don't know what it is and you learn about it. What's the big deal? But for some reason, that wine list is very, very intimidating to some people.
Yep. Yeah. I had a couple of sort of guidelines for people. And one is, like, wine is fun. Mm-hmm. It's fun. You're not there. And the other one is, particularly if you go to a restaurant, there is no bad wine.
Right.
Like, you could just close your eyes and pick, and you'll probably be okay, because somebody's tasted that wine and curated that list. You know, when you probably try to get things onto a list, mm-hmm. you got somebody to taste, they got to decide if they like it, they got to decide if it fits. Yeah. So there's no clunkers on the list. They don't want a clunker. They make sure of it. And so people worry, I'm going to make a mistake. There's no mistakes to be made, right? And then my last sort of guideline is, I go, and you read it in the book, but like, pizza and ice cream, there is no bad wine, right? I mean, even
you added something else in the book.
I'm trying to keep it PG. I can go PG-13. So the real line is, like, pizza, sex, and ice cream, there is no bad wine, because even not such good sex is pretty good. So same thing with wine, right?
Absolutely.
You can't make a mistake.
Absolutely. And you know, and it's funny, I have never said those words to anybody, but you're absolutely right. Those wine lists are curated. So somebody knows what they're doing, chose those wines. So they're not, you can't go wrong. You are absolutely right. You are
total safety net. So what are you worried about? You can't make a mistake. And even if it's not the greatest wine in the world, it's pretty good. So
right.
We're good. Yeah.
And you can always order another one.
Exactly.
So you went through the WSET program, like you mentioned. And I'm always curious, because when I see people who are in both fields, who have gone through both programs, the Master Sommelier and then the WSET, like, they're very different viewpoints. And
yes.
I've listened to people go through the tasting grid for the MS, and it's different. So, like, how do you train your brain? Or I guess my big question is, how do you see it as different? And then have you merged the two in your own brain, or do you tend to lean towards one or the other? So,
yeah, they are different. And the primary difference is that WSET is more theoretical. It's really book learning and tasting. And sommelier is guided for people that are going to do service in a restaurant, most likely. So the idea that you would be like a wine distributor salesperson, you shouldn't be a sommelier. To be honest, I shouldn't be a sommelier, to be honest with you, because I'm not going to, like, I was in the restaurant in college. I'm not going back except as a customer, probably. So the more theoretical non-service, WSET, if you're going to be in a restaurant or in service in some way, then sommelier is probably more appropriate. But you really did nail the differential between the two, beyond the fact that there's service in one and no service in the other. It's the tasting methodology is different. And Guild of Master Sommeliers has a grid, very specified, the order in which we do things, you know, fruit, non-fruit. I mean, we go right down the grid. Everybody does it the same. Design, what we call the deductive tasting method. But what's interesting is the language you can use can be a bit of your own language, right? So I could use a phrase like baby's breath or white flowers or chamomile In the case of WSET, since it is a written test, the language is completely specified. If I used a word to describe a wine that's not on their language list, doesn't count. Even if I'm right, it doesn't count. If I said dusty rose or dusty overripe plum, and it's not on the grid, their grid, doesn't count. And so for me, because I kind of learned Guild first, I had to retrain my brain to do WSET and get really specific about the wording I used to make sure I could get the points on the test, because that's what it's about there. Having said that, now that I don't have to do it for the test, I prefer the Guild. It's a little more freeform, a little more you can be you. So I prefer Guild personally, but they're both valuable. The other thing is that the conclusion, at least up to the advanced level, on a wine is only what is the quality level of the wine, and is it ageable or not? Is it age-worthy or not? That's it. I think more interesting and requiring probably more theoretical knowledge on the guild side is country, region, grape, age. At the master level, maybe estate even, you know, they really know what they're doing, or sub-ABA. And so they get very specific about what it is. Now, they will also be able to comment on ageability, but ageability is kind of a small thing in the scheme of being able to bring it down to, you know, this is a, you know, a wine from, you know, Paso Robles in this particular sub-ABA, probably a 2015 based on the ripeness and the age. And I mean, that's pretty cool stuff, right?
Yeah, that blows my mind. It just blows my mind that somebody can do something like that. And, you know, I don't know how many wines you have to taste to be able to hone in to, you know, who is the winery or the chateau, never mind the vintage. Like I can taste and I can say, oh, it was a warm vintage or a cool vintage. Like, okay, I can do that, you know, and be right most of the time. but it's also a very rare occasion I ever do that. But, you know, to be able to narrow it down to what the guild can do is beyond impressive to me.
It is cool, yeah. And they do it because if I can do that, I can describe the wine to a client. I mean, I'll really be able to describe it if I can dig in deep enough to be able to do that. It also has a lot of theory behind it. So, for example, if it's fruit forward, it's New World. If it's fruit sort of secondary on the bus but not driving the bus, it's Old World, for example, right? You can look at the color of the, you know, how transparent is the wine, and I can tell if it's a thick skin or a thin skin grape, right? I can taste the alcohol content and the acid content and figure out if it's cool climate or warm climate. So all that theory goes, all right, it's Old World, warm climate, right? Yeah, exactly. Right. That's all we're doing is we're just every little piece of data is narrow, and then you make your best guess based on all of that narrowing.
And when you're taking the test, do they give you, all right, well, that was kind of close, so we're going to give that to you. Like, is there logic behind it, or do you have to be this specific, you know, rigid or you know, do you know what I'm trying to say? Like, do they give you gimme points?
No, you can get partial credit.
Okay. The gimme in golf, you know?
Yeah. They give you two reds and two whites, and you have to go through the process. But, you know, if I make the acid call right, I make the tannin call right, and I name the fruits and the non-fruits and the minerals and the all correctly, blah, blah, all the way down, and I miss the grape in the year, you probably still pass, right? But if you take a wine and you call it Old World and it's New World,
that's a bigger problem.
That might be a problem.
That's a bigger problem.
Having said that, they don't really tell you how they score everything, so it's a little bit of magic behind the curtain.
Right. You just get called in and you say yay or nay. Right? So your website is by the same name, Professional Drinking. So how long have you had the website? How long about the blog? Because you also write blogs on there. How do you put this all together? When did this whole concept come into your brain and get that to fruition?
Yeah, you know, shortly after I passed introductory. So that would have been a few years back, three, four years back at this point. And, you know, the entrepreneurial brain, because I have a business brain, it goes, I wonder what I can do with this. What would be interesting? And so I grabbed the website and I began to publish articles. Frankly, as I learned things, I would publish them, basically. As I learned about ports, I'd publish an article on ports. As I learned about champagne, I'd publish an article on champagne. And over time, I'd say a third of the book came from those blog postings as well. So I've been kind of quiet on posting for a little while as I finished up the book. I'll get back to it now that the book is done. So yeah, about 3-4 years, it's reasonably popular. It's probably in the top 100 wine blogs in the world, but,
congratulations.
I don't know how much traffic that really means, but whatever. It's fun. I enjoy it. It's for me. If people get something out of it, it's awesome.
And I think that that's really a great way, at least for me, to learn. Like, I can sit in a classroom and, you know, I can learn stuff, but then I have that where I believe I only have X amount of brain cells. And when something new comes in, something else has to go out. So I also have to reiterate it to myself over and over. So like when I was studying for the WSET, they joke about, you know, index cards, but I not only had like, I don't know, 450-ish index cards. I then went to technology, believe it or not, and did that Quizlet app, and then converted all of those things into the Quizlet app so that, well, A, if I was traveling somewhere, I could find, you know, I can look through them. So it was always with me. But B, the more I write, the more I type, the more I see, it gets drilled in there a bit more. So yeah. Writing a blog.
I did index cards, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of index cards.
Yeah. Do you still have them?
More than I studied for any class in college, to be honest with you.
Neither did I. did you save your index cards?
Yeah, I got them.
Yeah.
They're over there.
They're like,
yeah,
like
that. So, yeah, it's like that. It's a bigger pile of index cards, yeah.
It is funny, those index cards, but they work. You know, you think when you were a little kid, they taught you on flashcards, right? And now it's just adult flashcards. Much more fun.
Mm-hmm.
Much more
Not
fun.
Wine.
Yeah. So you have actually written quite a few books. So I have written blogs. I used to do poetry. I do all that type of stuff. But that's all kind of like, all right, I get this idea. I write it. Like you were saying, you learned about champagne. You wrote a blog about champagne. Writing a book has to be way more involved than writing a blog. I mean, whoop, I can pop out a blog, right? You can't just pop out a book, or I guess you can. So can you take us through the process? So when you decided, you know, I'm going to write this professional drinking book, what's that process from idea to finally having it out?
Yeah. So I'd written this is my second book. So I wrote one about business, a boring business book, but, that book took me a long time. That was almost 2.5 years end to end. So I had a bunch of ideas. I outlined them, began to fill in the blanks by, you know, writing those chunks. And it was really short. I didn't have enough content to really do a book appropriately. And it probably it's my disease. I try to be content dense in my books. You know, I read some books and they're like, it's like eating cotton candy, you know, like, oh, it's over. And I tend to go denser on my books. And so maybe that's a fault of mine, that if I lightened up a little bit, I would have been able to finish that one earlier. But I got to a point, I'm like, all right, I got to go think some more and develop some more. And then once I figured that out, I was able to add it and then finish off the book. So it took a while to get that book done. On this one, I knew pretty much what I wanted, and I had about half of it written because of the blogs. I just aggregated the blogs, organized them, and said, all right, what holes do I have? I have a co-conspirator that I work with, a guy named Darren Dahl. We sat down for a day, banged out the other bunch that we needed, and by the time we were done with that first day plus my blog stuff, we were at 42,000 words. You need about 55,000 to have a book of that size. It's about a 216 page book, you know, 8.5 by 5.5. So I said, all right, what content gaps am I missing, right, now that I've got all that in place? And then I wrote blogs for about 4 months, just adding those chapters in blog form, effectively. All right, I need something about, you know, hangovers, for example. All right, I'll write a blog post. I'll research hangovers. I'll write a blog post. Boom. But that's the chapter in the book. Then I had a couple people read it, just a couple, and they gave me really good feedback. The best feedback is I just put all kinds of stuff in there, the whole kitchen sink. And a friend of mine said, you know, it doesn't know what it wants to be. It's not clear in terms of a voice, and it's just stuff. Mm-hmm. So I end up just deleting entire chapters. And they have a phrase, they say, editing is like killing your babies.
Oh, I can get it.
No, it feels like that.
Yeah.
you're like, this is a really good chapter. And you go, oh, God. Like,
oh. I've poured my heart and soul into that chapter.
Yes, 100%. And so that was tough. I got to tell you, I'm like, oh. A couple I left in, I finally go, all right, I just got to get rid of them. I got to do it. And I deleted them. And so got it down to the right form. Then I engaged some help. Not everybody would do it this way, but a structural editor to go through and help me. Does it make sense? Does the flow make sense? Does the chapter order make sense? Is there a theme there? And then a fine edit, which is just English grammar. Because I'm an engineer and English is a second language for me, so you know, I need help. And then a proofreader to check for errors. Actually, two proofreaders, and then a cover designer. And what's funny is, in the old days, you used to have a publisher to do this. Mm. Not anymore. These people are all freelancers, and for not a lot of money, they're sitting in their home. They're happy to do it for not a lot of money. You send them the manuscript, they do their work, send it back, you send them a few bucks, we're done.
Wow.
And you can publish it yourself as well, you know, through a variety of techniques. So this book, Tooth to Tail, from the very first sit down just with my co-conspirator to now, it was under 11 months.
Wow.
10 months and a bit.
Wow.
Pretty quick.
And currently you only have it in a virtual form. Right, in electronic form. When is the hard? Well, it's a paperback, right? When is it coming? Today? Or you've got it?
On my birthday.
Oh,
on my birthday.
Yay! Little birthday
so
gift to yourself.
On Amazon in a Kindle format or paperback, and there's an audiobook that's getting cleared through, and that'll be available in a couple of days as well. So yeah.
So that opens up a whole other realm of questions for me. So. Kindle books, okay. I honestly have not read very much that's not wine related in I don't know how long. I need to like get back to my fiction and you know supernatural stuff, right? But there, I was reading Amazon review of somebody's book that I was maybe going to buy, whatever, and they were like, "Do not get the Kindle version. It is completely off." Like, it's not set to be a Kindle version. Like, charts are half on one page, half on another page, and, you know, like, the pictures. And I think back to when I used to have a Kobo, which was pre-Kindle, and I would read a book, and it would be that way. There would be, this half a picture here, and then you'd press to turn the page, and the other half of the picture's there. How do you deal with that? Like, are you the person who makes sure it's fit? Like, how do you get it to be Kindle?
I had somebody help me with the interior design, and you look through the book, it has pictures and kind of, it's all kind of looks nice. I didn't do that. I had somebody else do that, and they're kind of expert at it. And they also converted it to Kindle and then made sure it looked good
in
a Kindle or did not just Kindle, but all the platforms because they're all the same. There's a standard format that you have to get it into, but they did that for me again, not in a lot of bucks and, made sure it looked nice.
Oh, okay.
So if you were to get the Kindle, if you were to download the Kindle version, it should look pretty identical to the paperback back at this point.
So that just whoever's book that was just didn't edit it correctly, whatever. And then
they just transferred it over and didn't check it or whatever, you know.
And do you get to choose, like, do you say, I want it on Kindle or I want to have an audiobook, or do you just say, nope, I want paperback or hard copy, if there even are hard copies anymore, I don't, you know, like, are you the person who's choosing all that? Or you're like, I'm going to go across the board and do as much as I can get it off on.
I made that decision, but you know, really, all the paperbacks nowadays are on demand printed. So there's a big giant laser printer, if you will. You hit, I'd like the book, click, the laser printer whirs up and it spits out the other end of book, drop it in a box and they send it to you. So there's no, it's just sitting there. Right? It's just sitting on some computer waiting for you to say, I want to order it, and you want a hard copy, and they go, okay, hard copy. It's the same as the Kindle, basically. They're the same. Yeah. You're sitting on some computer, and you say, I want it in Kindle or Barnes & Noble Nook or whatever your platform is. And it goes, okay, and it just sends it to you. Same exact
idea. Wow, there's a little behind the scenes. Like, I don't know, I guess I always envisioned it still being that day that you get it in the mail and you as the author open up your book and you're like, here it is.
Well, I do have that. I did have that.
But you had to order your own version.
But it was just printed off a laser printer. And that, now, if I had done hardcover, right, which I did not on this book, there's some on-demand technology there, but fundamentally you do have to print those kind of old-fashioned and have big stacks of books sitting in a warehouse and they pull one off the shelf and they put it in a box. It's a little different, but I didn't want to do that this time. I did it on my last book. I didn't want to do that this time. And then the audio book, you basically just have to have somebody read it, and then it has to be put in a certain format and then uploaded to Amazon and the other platforms, and then off you go. And in this case, I read the book.
Okay.
So I went to a local studio and, you know, had the earphones and the microphone, and I read through the book, and it was cool. It was fun. It took me a couple of days.
Oh, wow. Cool. I would, like, keep messing up. Damn, I got to do it again. Damn.
Oh, totally. Totally. Yeah, and he'd make a little mark, and I'd say it again, and then he'd clean it up. And, yeah.
Oh, so you had actually touched on it a little bit, but I actually have a friend who is an author. His name is Ty Hutchinson, so shout out Ty. And he writes these Abby Kane FBI thrillers. And that's really like the stuff that pre-wine taking over my entire life. That's the type of stuff that I would read is like thrillers, or I love supernatural stuff and apocalyptic. I'm kind of doom and gloom. So I need the wine to make me smile more, I guess. But one of his things he did was he called me a beta reader and he sent me his book. And I got it before anybody else, and I took notes in it, and I did exactly what you were talking about. Is like, I was like, oh, I don't understand where Abby's going here. What happened? And so, is that something you mentioned? You did it on this one. You sent it to a couple people. Did you do that on your first book also?
I did, because you know you just can't taste your own cooking sometimes, right? You've written it and you've read it, and you your eyes cross and you can't see the errors anymore, and you know you're reading through it and it makes sense in your brain because you know what you meant,
right?
But it actually doesn't say that on the page anymore. You're blind to it, so you really need a fresh couple of and what I found even on the proofreading. After that, the sort of more structural comments that you made, the beta reading kind of comments, you need a couple of proofreaders. You only do one proofread or even two formal, like, and this is their job. This is like what they do. You still need a couple of different people doing it because they're going to miss stuff. So, in fact, my first book, I'll tell you a quick story. I had it proofread formally, the whole deal, and a friend of mine opens the book, and she goes, oh, that word's spelled wrong. I'm like, son of a, how do you do that? It's a couple hundred page book, and you open it and just point to the error in the book. I'm like, but it happens.
Well, I'll share. One of the podcasts I listen to is The Goblet of Wine. And it's these two British women. I have no idea what their names are, no idea what they look like, whatever, but they love Harry Potter. And the whole podcast is them going through the books of Harry Potter and just dissecting each chapter. So like each podcast is like 40 minutes long, and of course they drink while they're doing it, but they basically dissect it. And last week's episode, they got so like giddy excited because one of them had a first edition of the book, and in it something happened, and I mean, it's Harry Potter, so I will, you know, whatever, I don't want to go into it that far, but something happened, and then the other one had a different edition of the book, and it was different. So in the first edition, the father came out, you know, came as the ghost and said something that kind of was cool in how he said it, but it wasn't right. So, but she couldn't change it, so she just had you know, the mother come out first, which then changed the whole kind of conversation.
Wow.
And these girls recognized it, like, between first edition. I mean, that's really reading a book. I mean,
But wow.
So it happened to you. If it happens to J.K. Rowling, come on, it can happen to anybody, right?
It happens to everybody. My Harry Potter one was in the early days. I bought one of the books for my kids in England when I was there, and I brought it back. And I can't remember what it was, the Sorcerer's Stone, but it had a different name in England.
Oh, wow.
It was like the Necromancer's Stone or something.
Yes,
like that.
Yes. So, I read about that.
The one they read was the Necromancer's Stone, not the Sorcerer's Stone. So kind of fun.
You still have it? Did you keep it? Like, I would keep that just as, you know.
I don't know.
No. I would be like, look at this. This says something different, you know.
Yeah, but it is.
That's cool. Yep. So let's get into your book. So in the first section of your book, you go into being a professional drinker. And you mentioned that there's not a lot of professionals out there, but we do have a lot of amateurs. So aiming for Olympic status. So as someone who's gone through quite a bit of formal training, what do you recommend for people to do? Do you recommend them to take the classes? How can they become more comfortable, become more professional? And do they have to go through those WSATs? Because I'm not going to lie, they're not cheap.
And it's hard.
Yeah, it's really hard. Particularly
as you go up the levels, it gets really hard. Well, first thing you should do is go buy my book.
All right. Well, that is obvious.
Well, if you're going to set me up like that, I've got to take the opportunity, right? Having said that, I have a simple way to kind of grow your and just remember, like, it's all fun. You can't make a mistake. And just chill. Like, we're here to have a good time. Just chill, right? But if you want to expand sort of your wine knowledge, I think the really simple way to do that is sort of what do you like and what don't you like? It is to take the seven noble grapes, right? So Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, Riesling, Cabernet Sauvignon, Pinot Noir, Merlot, and Syrah, and do an old world version and a new world version of each of those seven. Now, I mean, you know, I've left off dozens and dozens of really interesting wines, including Cabernet Franc from California, right? Just try those, and you'll go, I kind of like New World wines, and I kind of like Australian wines, because I like that jammy, fruity, or you say, no, I like the kind of more subtle, you know, earthy notes that I get in French wines. Okay, great. Like just knowing that and what grape you like is a huge advantage when you walk in and look at a wine list, because when a sommelier comes to you and says, can I help you? And for me, they're there to help you. I mean, they love that job. These are wine geeks. I mean, they love to help. If you say, I surveyed a bunch of sommeliers and you saw that in the book probably, and they go, a lot of people go, I like fruity wines or I like sweet wines. And like, it's not incredibly helpful. But if you say, you know, I really like Merlot from Sonoma, and I also like Syrah from Rome. They go, okay, pretty different, but we can work with that in terms of finding something that you might like for dinner, right? So it's good to have that basic knowledge of here's what I like and here's what I don't like. So because you can just pick something you like in that region, or when you tell the somm, you can give them a little better guidance. So for me, chill, buy my book, and then do 14 bottles of wine. Seven noble grapes old world, seven noble grapes new world, and you'll have a pretty good like triangulation on what you like and what you don't, and then you can spread out from there.
My last blog post, last week's blog post, was actually talking about climate change, and I brought in that. That's the kind of the angle I went at in talking about climate change. Is, you know, if you like Pinot Noir, you know, it's a cool climate. What's going to happen as this climate increases? And, you know, Pinot Noir is kind of a finicky grape. It's not, you know, as that temperature goes up, your Pinot Noir is going to change. You might not love your Pinot Noir if even Pinot Noir can go. And then I was talking about how, you know, like the flavors of a warm climate of that same similar old world, new world, right? You can take that one grape variety and taste it in a warm climate, or taste that one grape variety in a cool climate. Well, your palate probably is going to go towards one or the other. Well, what happens as all of this changes, though, that profile of that grape is going to change. And but that's how you pin down what you like and what you don't like. Just drink more wine, right? Buy your book. Trust. Buy your book. Buy professional drinking, how to be a professional drinker, and drink a lot of wine.
Try a lot of wine. And you know, I love the wine by the glass programs. Mm-hmm. You know, if you it's a great way to sort of try something that I've never tried before.
Right.
It's not a high commitment. It's one glass, for goodness sake. I'm not committing to a whole bottle even. And if I don't like it, like, geez, don't even finish it. Just get another one. I mean, it's $15, $14. I mean, I know it's money, but it's not like I bought a $70 bottle of wine and I'm like, oh, I got to finish it now, right?
Right.
You know what? So I like that as a great way to sort of broaden out your palate. Just try something new.
Right.
And that is cool because that's where the SOM or the general manager is saying, they're sort of crowd pleasers, right? Wine by the glass. No fancy stuff, but it's right down the middle. Nice, tasty, yummy. You're not going to get upset by it. And so you can't go far wrong with wine by the glass either in my book.
Excellent. Excellent. We're going to go on to part two, where you talk types of beer, liquor, and some cocktails. So my palate is wine and beer. I have a lot of difficulty with spirits. The craft, I'm love watching the craft drinks be made. That's a whole other talent. But what about you? Are you into all different libations? What do you like? What are you tips for other libations?
Yeah, well, the sommelier program is not, there's another difference between WSET and
right.
the guild. Sommeliers need to know all wines and spirits and all beverages. So we know beer and sake and champagne and port and sauternes and liquor and cocktails, and we know it all, right? And that's not the case in WSET. So I had to learn all that because I was kind of a wine guy. So I like cocktails. I'll do them occasionally just to mix it up, almost more to just keep my brain fresh on what the cocktails are. I tend to go for the classic cocktail. So the whole mixologist thing is super cool, and you're so right about the show, right? They're like making this stuff and smoking this and special cherries. I mean, it's so cool. But the problem I have with it is, let's say I have a cocktail and I love it, right? I'm like, oh my God, it's the best cocktail in the whole world. And I go somewhere else, I'm like, I want a cocktail like that guy made for me the other place. And they go, we have no idea what you're talking about, right? You know?
Right.
So I tend to stick to the classic cocktails and say, give me your best version of a Manhattan or a gin and tonic or a Paloma or a whatever. So having said that, if you break the cocktail world, just to pick on that for a second, into mostly alcohol and a little bit of something like a martini, so gin or vodka and a little bit of vermouth, or a Manhattan, same idea, versus a mixed drink like a gin and tonic. Or so I tend to skew towards the mixed drink because I'm with you, they're too strong, you know? I mean, I don't mind it occasionally, but I like, if I'm going to enjoy it, a little something in there. And lately, I've been drinking Paloma, which is tequila, grapefruit juice, and a little lemon lime soda.
Oh, okay.
It's super yummy. It really is. It's a great summer drink, real easy, a little bit of alcohol, tequila in that case. And, you know, you don't want to drink three of them, but one is very nice. And then you kind of roll into the meal. But having said that, there's nothing wrong with starting with wine, too. You know, and for me, I go, you know, you want to go lighter to heavier across your meal. So I'll get a Chablis or a Chardonnay from somewhere and start there and kind of move into the lighter reds and then a heavier red maybe later in the evening. Or, you know, what's always good, champagne. You can never go wrong with champagne. Bubbles are always good, right?
Bubbles are good whenever, for whatever. Right. You're happy, bubbles. You're sad, bubbles. What? Bubbles. Bubbles is the answer to it all.
I think I wish more people thought like that, because it's got a rap of being like a celebration drink.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, it's like Tuesday. Let's drink champagne, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, that's a marketing thing that came back to bite them, you know, because I think years ago, that is what they wanted it to be. I mean, I don't know, but that's my opinion. You know, if you look at advertisements, marketing of years and years ago, it was always the rich people drinking it. It was always a celebration. It was always this. Mm. And they did a great job marketing it that way. Now it's a little tough to change that marketing. But I will take a sparkling, champagne, whatever.
I don't mean to narrow it like that.
But sparkling, and honestly, my two favorites are like $12 a bottle. You know, it's
what are they? Do tell.
Chateau Saint Jean. They're both rosés, actually, sparkling rosé, brut rosé. I'm sorry, and then Gruet out of New Mexico is like one of my favorites, and they have a range of them, and I drink like three of them. You know, like three of their. They have a brut. They have a brut rosé, a blanc de blanc. Like, you know, and then if I want to up it a little, you know, I'll do a Domaine Carneros or a Gloria Ferrer.
I've had Gruet and I've had Domaine Carneros, both yummy, delicious wines.
Yeah, but you can go into Total Wine for $12 and pick up a bottle of sparkling. That is an any day, every day celebration. Celebrate the day. That's my opinion.
Made it through Tuesday.
Yes. So in the book you have, I literally laughed out loud. I laughed out loud with your, what does the drink say about you?
Good.
And the reasoning is you had rum and coke equals a frat party. And I have a friend from college and that's what she drank. It was Diet Coke, but it was kind of the same thing. So rum and Diet Coke. And we would go to the frat parties and she would have a glass, you know, that held like the entire bottle of rum and like, you know, the splash of Coke, kind of how I like mimosas, you know, a lot of sparkling and just a drop of orange juice. But that was her drink for the night. And she would just carry this big, meanwhile, we're all like drinking out of the keg and doing all this stuff. But I laughed out loud because it's a frat party. So how did you come up with these like brainstorms of what these drinks, and if you can share a couple of others, because they were good.
Thanks. You know, I guess those drinks just occupy a little space in my brain when I see somebody drinking it. That's my connection, and that's what I'm putting on the – and from a point of view of professional drinking, you just got to be aware that when you drink a certain thing, people go, rum and coke, she's at a frat party, right? Yeah. I mean, you know, so you got to just be aware that it does communicate something to people. So I don't remember them all, so I'm going to look
them up. I'm sorry.
Hang on, no problem. I can do that. Take me 2 seconds. There we go. All right, well, martini, James Bond, right? I mean, it's just so classic.
Shake it, not stirred.
Sazerac, it's Mardi Gras, right? I mean, that's a New Orleans drink. I mean, for me, it always says Mardi Gras. We're here to have a party.
Party.
Strong, too. You got to be careful.
One is done.
mint julep, Southern Belle, right? You know, here at the Kentucky Derby, having my mint julep. Let's see. I'll give you another one. Mimosa, which you mentioned. Yeah. Brunch fan.
Yep. Mimosas for me are always when I'm flying in and out of San Francisco and I'm at the United Club. I walk in and the it's kind of sad. Well, since pandemic, they probably have forgotten me. But before that, I was in and out of that airport so frequently that I would walk in and they're like, mimosa, mimosa.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, that's funny. And then just let two last ones. Mojito, ready for vacation, which is – and then margarita, you're on vacation.
On vacation. Pina colada, margarita, yes, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, no doubt.
But I thought they were funny.
A business setting, if you order a pina colada, people go, what?
Right.
So right. just got to think about it.
Right. And so that was going to be my next question is, when you're combining your CEO with your wine and your drinking and professional drinking, like, how do you, you have a section in it where you talk about somebody who's your host hands you a wine list. That's a tricky thing. So you want to just go into that a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the most stress-inducing things when they go, you know, you're a guest, and maybe we don't know each other all that well. It's a business thing. They go, here, you know wines. Why don't you pick the wine? And you're like, okay, I can pick the wine, but how much of this guy's money am I supposed to spend, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's really easy to make a boo-boo there. And so I got a couple of rules of thumb. One is you could look for – there's a couple of what I call lifesaver wines on most lists in a business dining place. Silver Oak, Alexander Valley, or Camus. And they usually sit on the list at $125 to $150 a bottle. And in a business context, when I'm on an expense account and all that, that's about the number that you can spend. So for me, you can do the easy, hit the easy button and just order one of those. And you know, they would sell hundreds of thousands of bottles of that mm-hmm. stuff because it's a known brand name. So they've done a good job in that regard. But to be honest, it's not the best wine for your money. I mean, you could do better for the same money. And so for me, I go, all right, $125, that's my number because I know it's acceptable because that's Alexander Valley. I'm going to find something else on the list that I like that's $125 a bottle, and I shouldn't get in trouble with my host. The other thing I'll do is sometimes when they hand me the list, and I did this recently meaning just before COVID hit, I open the list and I go, are you having a good year? And they go, just okay. And I go, thank you, I understand, right? And they said,
that's very clever.
We're having a great year. I'm like, awesome. And I start thumbing to the back of the list, right? The other rule of thumb is if you look at the entree price and you do two or three times the entree price, you're probably in about the right price point there too. So let's say you're in a steak restaurant and it's $50 a steak on average. If you spend $100 to $150 a bottle, you're not spending a crazy amount of money at that point. You know, if you're going to go, if your host said, hey, go crazy, you know, you could go double that probably, right? If you're trying to cut it down, you want to be at the low end of that number. On the other side, let's say we're at a pasta place and it's, you know, $25 a plate or something like that. $50 a bottle, $75 a bottle is probably all you really want to spend at that point. So those are a couple of ways that you don't embarrass your host if they don't share a number with right. you. And having said that, when I'm the host, I'll usually hand you the list. I'll come over to you. I'll hand you the list and say, hey, Lori, would you mind picking a bottle of wine? Something around $100 a bottle would be awesome. And then you know, right. I admit it, it's not uncomfortable for you.
Right.
Because I've told you, gave him some guidance, right?
Right?
Or if I say, hey, Lori, here's the list. Go crazy. We're having an amazing year. Just pick something that would be fun and awesome and maybe something special that we would never normally order, right?
Right.
And you're like, game on.
I can do that.
Yeah, right?
That's awesome. I always try to, when they hand me the menu, I always try to find the funky, you know, like the things that aren't a typical, like I love introducing people to Albarinos as a starter
yes.
wine. They're
yes.
low on the totem pole of price and the
yep.
quality is out of control, you know?
Yep.
So I also try to look for that. But I love the tip of the dollar because that is, it's kind of like you get the knot in your stomach of, you don't want to embarrass your host by, you know, him seeing his eyes bulge out when he gets the bill at the end of it. And then that can also, you know, roll over into your business deal, right? If you've upset him by a dollar amount. So I like that. I like that. I like
yep,
it a lot.
Absolutely. Yeah, I love Albarino as a starter option for people who haven't tried it before. It's delicious. And the only reason they haven't tried it is they go, it's weird and I don't know what it is.
Right.
So I don't want to make a mistake. And It's actually completely opposite. It's not a mistake. It's a great choice.
Right. Yeah, totally. I've turned quite a few people onto Albarinos. So,
nice.
Yeah. So here's a question about tipping. Okay.
Mm.
I always find it, you know, when you're ready to tip, right, you're at your table no alcohol, it's a piece of cake, right? Piece of cake, you're 20%, 25%, whatever your, whatever your number is your tip. But now I'm at a table and I, meal-wise, is, I don't know, whatever amount, but now I've ordered a $200 bottle of wine, okay? So my first part of my question is, A, how do you tip on when you're ordering wine like that? And B, do you tip the sommelier, like a maitre d', does he get his own tip? Or is he expected to share along with the waiters, or is he on his own salary and non-tip?
Yeah. So when you get wine, if you haven't gone insane on the wine budget, I just tip on the whole amount. Now, I might tip towards the lower end of my band. You know, if I'm a 15 to 20 kind of guy, I might be more at, you know, 16, 17. But I might even go to 20, right, if I didn't go crazy. If I went crazy on the wine, like we just backed up the truck on the wine, I'm going to be at the lower end of my range because, you know, I bought a $200 bottle of wine or a couple of them.
Right.
Now, that's a big old bill, and, you know, I know they gave me the glassware, and I know they opened the bottles, and I know, but they're going to make their money. And, in fact, a dirty little secret of wine is almost all restaurants that have a – if they didn't have a wine program, fine restaurants, if they didn't have a wine restaurant program, they would not make money.
Right.
They make all their money on the wine and spirits. Even, like, Michelin-starred amazing restaurants that are charging hundreds of dollars for their little tasting menu – if they weren't selling wine, they would lose money, which is crazy. So they make their money on wine. So that's my – I just tip on the number. And if I went heavy on wine, I'll back it to my lower end of my range. If I was just kind of normal, you know, $50 – a couple of $50 bottles of wine on a few hundred-dollar bill, I'm like, I'll just tip the same old percentage. Now, so how do sommeliers get paid? They get a salary, and they get a percentage – depends on the restaurant – either a percentage of the tip pool – or a percentage of all the spirits that are sold in the entire place. So if they came and they helped you buy $500 of wine, they're going to do just fine because they're going to get a percentage of that wine that you purchased, and they'll be just fine at the end of the night. So you don't really have to worry about independently tipping the sommelier. So for me, I do a couple of things with the sommelier if they're really good. One is, if I brought in a bottle of wine, not if I order off the list, because I assume they've tasted everything on the list, probably, or darn close. But if I brought in a bottle of wine, which you can do in a lot of places, and it's a special bottle, maybe like this Behringer 07 Reserve. I mean, that's a reasonably special bottle. And I'll go, have you ever tasted that wine before? And if the son goes, I've never had it. I go, why don't you grab the taste for yourself, take it back, and look, like I said, they're wine geeks. They're like, a good sip of wine like that is a pretty darn good tip, right? And the other thing I'll do is that they really did a nice job for us. I mean, they really helped us. They were very attentive. I might grab $20 or something, or depending on the restaurant, maybe even more if it was a really high-end restaurant, and I'll find them and just give them that independently on top of whatever else they're going to make. I know that, you know, it's not going to change their day. It's more a thank you, you know, that you really did a nice job, and I really appreciate what you did for us. And you know, if you go to the same place a couple times, and they will remember you, just like your United Club. So
if somebody comes into the restaurant and you get seated, how do you know, I guess is the question, of whether they are going to have a sommelier? And, like, is he going to, or she, going to come directly to you as soon as you sit down? Is that the person who comes first, or do you as the guest need to ask to see the song?
Yeah, I always ask. And so the first person that comes to the table is the waiter or waitress, and they'll do the whole welcome to the place, da da da. Here are a couple of specials. Can I get a cocktail order for anybody? At that point, I'll say, hey, we're going to have wine. Do you have a sommelier? And they go, absolutely do. I'll make sure she comes over, he comes over, and they'll take care of you. You go, awesome. Or they go, no, we don't. I said, well, then I'll usually ask, who handles your wine program? Is it your general manager? Because a lot of smaller restaurants, the GM or an assistant GM runs the wine program. They go, yeah, actually, it's Sally, who's our assistant manager. And I go, would you mind having Sally come over and chat with us for a few minutes? Sally comes over. She knows that wine list like cold.
Right.
And I go, look, I'm looking for something about $100. I like Old World. I want that. She goes, what's everybody having? Lamb. Okay, let me go find some. How about this, sir? You know, that would be fabulous. Let's give it a try. And off you go. So the waiter will come first. Now, sometimes the waiter says, oh, I can help you with that. And this may be in a wine snob. I go, if you got a som, I'd really prefer to talk to the som. You know, some waiters and waitresses are really well trained and they're pretty decent, but they're not going to be at the level of the sommelier in terms of really being knowing the list and really being able to help you. So I generally would. And I tell the story in the book when I was a waiter in college, and I knew let's just go with zero because that's close enough to how much wine knowledge I had. Except I like the wine my dad gave me. People would ask me, well, what wine, you know, they go, what wine should we have? And I'm clueless. So I asked one of the older waiters, and he said, I always recommend the same thing. It's a Mouton Cadet. Now, Mouton Cadet is a French medium quality, village level, red Bordeaux. It's okay. Inoffensive would be the best word you could use for it, right? So I would recommend Mouton Cadet because, frankly, I didn't know anything else. So you're asking me, this 21-year-old kid, what wine you should drink? Or whatever. Mouton Cadet, sir, I recommend it. It's quite nice.
And it sounds very fancy. It sounds very fancy, and it's Mouton.
Yeah, Mouton, yeah, it sounds lovely. It's the other Mouton. Yeah.
But so it's a word they're going to recognize, probably.
That's probably why they named it that, yeah. So I would always go to the som. If they've got a som, use the person. They're there to help you.
Right.
It doesn't cost you anymore.
Okay. Excellent. So we are at about our hour, which is where I tend to wrap things up. But I don't want to go without you giving us a few tips from your book, because there really were some tips. So if you have like maybe four of your favorite tips from the book that we haven't discussed yet. And then obviously we need to know more about the book, where they can find you. We know that they can get it on Amazon, but where else can they get it and where can they find you?
Okay. So I'll give you three good tips.
Okay.
One is, when I show up at the table, there's always a question for people, which glass is mine? It's a round table and there's all these glasses. And yeah, you know what I'm going to tell you, right? You read the book. So, and I've coached hundreds and hundreds of CEOs and they've said, you know, top level strategy, helping them grow their business, sell their business for millions and millions of dollars. They go, Jim, this is the most useful thing you've ever taught me. So here we go. You make an okay sign with your hands. Now, as you're looking at it, that one looks a bit like a B. That one looks a bit like a D. And so I look down at the table. My bread is over here where the B is, and my drink is over here where the D is. So you show up at the table, right hand, the D is where your drink is, and the B is where your bread plate is. So you'll never make that mistake again, and it's a great thing to teach people so that they don't make the mistake. And I can tell you, I've been at dinners with CEOs, and I'll see them looking down.
Under the table.
Trying to figure out which glass is there. You're running this giant company, you can't remember which glass is yours, but it's really useful. So that's one. The other one is when I'm working with a sommelier, and particularly when I don't really know everybody at the table, so I'm not going to just yell out, I want to spend $75 on a bottle of wine or whatever my number is. What I'll do is I'll take the list, and the sommelier is looking over my shoulder, and I'll run my finger down the list. Now, I'm pointing at prices, not at wines. When I land on the price I'd like to spend, $75 in my example, I'd say, I'd like something from this region, please. Every sommelier worth their salt knows this guy wants to spend $75 on a bottle of wine. They go, okay, sir, I understand completely. What's everybody having for dinner? Da da da. Okay, I think I have something lovely from the Rhone that would go from Sonoma or from that would be perfect with your meal. Let me go grab that for you, right? So it's a great way to communicate a price without seeming like a schmuck. Like, hey, I'm only spending these guys $50. I'm not spending more than that. So, you know, it's a very elegant way to do that. And maybe the last tip is when they give you the little sample of wine, and for, let me give one other tip. When they put the cork on the table, You don't pick it up and smell it. All you're supposed to do with the cork is you want to, if you really want to, you can look and make sure that the label on the cork says the same thing as the label of the bottle. Because that's why people print it, is they used to counterfeit the bottles, and they would put the names on to try to prevent counterfeiting on the cork. But you give a little squeeze, just like that. And if it's pliable and moist, it's stored properly, and if you're done, you're done. If you give it a little squeeze and it's crumbly, you go, uh-oh, we might have a problem in how this wine was stored. That's it. No smelling, no, don't do any of that. No licking, none of that. So that's the first tip. Second tip is when they put the little taste in front of you, you're not there to critique the wine. You're not there to go, I get dusty plums and cherry and tobacco and nut. No, that's not what you're there to do. You're there to give it a swirl. Let me get a smell. One other. Now, you're only smelling for one thing. Wet dog or wet cardboard or musty basement, which is to say the wine has been corked. In other words, it's been contaminated with TCA, trichloroanisole, I guess it's called, which means it's no good. It's not going to be very tasty wine. And if you think the wine is corked, you call the sommelier over and go, I think this wine is corked. Could you smell it for me? Now, in a good restaurant, they'll give it a smell. Whether it is corked or not,
he will say it's corked.
They'll take it away. They'll take it away. And they'll go, we're so sorry, sir. Look, they didn't make the wine. It's not their fault it's corked. And they'll replace the bottle. And you don't have to worry. You can get the same bottle. It varies within a case. Like one can be corked and the other isn't. And it's random. So you could have exact, you don't have to get a different bottle. You do want to replace the glass because the glass is contaminated now. But you can get the same bottle, same type, and you'll be just fine. Now, people feel bad about this. They go, maybe it's only a little bit corked. It's okay. Because they're worried about the restaurant and they're going to get mad at me. And like I said, they didn't make the wine. And here's the dirty little secret. And you know this as a producer. If the wine is corked, they send it back and they get full credit. Mm-hmm. It's part of the cost of doing business in the wine business that some things are corked and the restaurants are going to send it back. And so if it's truly corked, it goes back. Here's what's really wild. If it's not corked, they'll take that bottle over behind the bar.
Party. No. No.
Okay. What they're supposed to do is they're supposed to sell it by the glass. So they'll have, you know, regulars, and they go, hey, I got a bottle of something really special. We're doing it for $25 a glass. Would you love that? Would you like to have a glass? And they're pouring some crazy nice bottle of wine. But they'll make more money
absolutely
selling it by the glass than they would have made selling you that darn bottle. So the restaurant never gets hurt if the bottle is corked. So don't worry. If you even smell a teeny bit of wet dog, send it back. It's all good. Nobody gets hurt. So those are my couple of quickie tips for you. So what was the rest? How to get a hold of the book and stuff?
How to get a hold of the book and where they can find you on the socials.
Yeah, no problem. So the book.
There it
and
is.
That's an advanced copy, but Professional Drinking. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can get the paperback. You can get the digital. The audio will be available as well through multiple platforms. A lot of independent bookstores have picked it up as well. So check your local bookstore. They may have it as well. If not, they can order it for you for sure. So really almost anywhere you buy your books, you can buy my book. And in terms of getting a hold of me, professionaldrinking.com is my website. Some great stuff there. And Pro Drinking is my Twitter handle. So we do a lot of tweeting and tips and stuff there as well if you're interested in following some of that. So
that is awesome. So thank you so much, Jim, for joining me. And it was fun. The hour flew for me. I hope it went fast for you also. And I appreciate you taking this time on your birthday in order to celebrate with me. And I wish I had a glass because I'd be clinking virtually with you right now. But just imagine I have one. So happy
Cheers.
Birthday, Slancha.
Thank you.
And enjoy the rest of your evening. And, you know, I will, you know, I am going to promote the book all over the place because it was not only informative, but there were fun, you know, it's a fun book and that makes it easier for people to learn. So,
awesome. You know, and you know, honestly, it wasn't designed for people like you. It was designed a little more for beginners and I think they'd get even more out of it, but, appreciate being your first author and, It was really a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. Thank you. I got birthday cake to eat after this.
Oh, happy peace for me. Okay.
Will do.
All right. Happy birthday. Thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks a lot, Lori.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
This has been another episode of Exploring the Wine Glass. Thanks for listening. If you have any suggestions on what topics you would like me to discuss, please reach out on social media. You can find me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook as Exploring the Wine Glass. I'm also on LinkedIn as Lori Hoytbud. Of course, you can always email me at exploringthewineglass@gmail.com. If you enjoyed our podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast catcher to help others find me more easily. And of course, tell your wine-loving friends, because if you like the podcast, they will too. Until next week, sláinte!